And so today, to get into this, does science need God? And so as I take this subject on this morning, I'm going to be honest and just say I feel inadequate. Does that make sense? Do you ever walk into something and you feel, And that's sort of how I feel. And the reason is because there's so much study and so much research that has been done over the last 100 years, and it seems like things are getting, there's that much more to evaluate even in the past year or 2 or 3 years. And so to keep up with this topic is such a huge accomplishment, I'd say. So I'm not making an apology or an excuse by starting out that way. I'm letting you know in humility, I know that I'm walking into a subject that there's a vast amount of knowledge and information out there that's way beyond this little brain that can handle. Does that make sense? And so I walk in humility, and I know there's some incredible thinkers out there that on both sides of this that I want to respect, and I want to talk about some of the statements that they've made and be able to walk through this subject in a way that's helpful for our lives on a daily basis. And so the question is, does science need God? Or even the flip side of that, does God need science? Richard Dawkins, we've talked about him before. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, says God is unnecessary. And Richard Dawkins, maybe you don't know this, he is a well-known atheist that's written several books, and he's a very, very smart person. But he says God is unnecessary. Science can explain nature without any help from supernatural causes like God. There is no need for a creator. And maybe you're saying, wow, I came to church and you're starting off with this. You see, here's the reality. If I'm going to dive into the subject, I might as well dive in deep, right? And so let's go to what people are really saying, because many people will agree with Richard Dawkins in the sense, like the video we saw where this teenager is struggling to talk about that, and he's just two in his classroom that's even talking about the opposite there of evolution. And many people will say something similar to this and essentially say that faith is just an emotional sentiment that does not fit into intellectual rigor. It's like faith over here in religion is an emotional kind of a thing. And if you break yourself down into different parts, you say, well, I have a mind and I can think and I have emotions and I feel. And you say, well, which one do you depend on when it comes to science? That's the intellectual fact and those things. And then you look at the religious side and say, well, that's just emotion. I mean, when you go to church to feel good. And we hear that all the time. And so that's essentially what he's pointing out there. Sam Harris recently wrote a book, 2015, he wrote a book called Waking Up. And so I read that recently. He said, our world is dangerously driven by religious doctrines that all educated people should condemn. Do you hear that? The world's dangerously driven by religious doctrines that all educated people should condemn. Now, it's interesting. I'm just going to pick on this statement just a little bit. Did you get your thinking caps on yet? You good? You tracking with me? Yes? Okay, good. He says, it's interesting what he's saying here, that all educated people should condemn this. Now, it's fascinating. What he's saying then is if you're religious, you're not educated, which is kind of an interesting statement, and maybe I'm picking a little bit too far on that. I don't think I am, but I think that's what he's really trying to say. But let me go further, because I want to take it out of context, because the next statement that he makes in this and the whole part that he writes in his book is really fascinating. He says, and yet there is more to understanding the human condition that science and secular culture generally admit. Now, this is in the beginning parts of his book, the first chapter of his book as he's writing this. And as he says this statement, and he's a well-known atheist. He's not someone that wants to mix in with creation in any kind of a sense or God in any kind of a way. And so when he says this, he backpedals quickly in the next parts of his book, and he says, now listen, I'm not changing my view. There is no God. I'm an atheist. And he says that very clearly, but he says this amazing statement, and his whole book is really about this statement then. There's something out there. There's something going on. We can't explain everything. It's an excellent statement. Francis Collins, another well-known, just a really intelligent person. He's the director of the Human Genome Project. And a little bit about his background. He was raised in an atheist home. And then later on, he became a Christian because of science. And so he wrote an article in the National Geographic magazine some years ago, and he says this: I am privileged to be somebody who tries to understand nature using tools of science. But it is also clear that there are some really important questions that science cannot really answer, such as, why is there something instead of nothing? Why are we here? In those domains, I have found that faith provides a better path to answers. I find it odd. Now, this is an amazing statement as well. He says, I find it odd that in today's culture, there seems to be a widespread presumption that scientific and spiritual views are incompatible. So he's just pointing out the obvious, that science and religion, science and the Bible, science and God, in our culture, they don't go together. You need to keep those separate. It's almost like separation of church and state. There's separation of science and God as well. And that's the sentiment or the myth that's put out there for us today. It's that faith and reason are incompatible. So if you believe in God, then you're simply not a thinking person. And so I want to tackle that this morning. Where did that come from? That's actually a newer kind of a thought or myth. Over the past 100 or so years, it's become something that's a little bit more prevalent in our thinking. And in our culture today, you'll see it as widespread. But I want to go back because I think it's our fault that it's there in some ways. The church's fault, the Christian's faith, it's our fault in that sense. And I want to tackle that and give you some history there. So let's go back to 1925. Remember 1925, right? Model A, and yeah, nice cars, and the cool dresses, and the dressing up. And yeah, okay, I don't remember any of that. But so 1925, I think this is where it really started. John Scopes was a substitute teacher in history in a public school. And so as he's a substitute teacher in Tennessee, it was against the law to speak on evolution. And so he spoke on evolution just a little bit, and it was enough to irritate some people. And it was kind of the thing that got it, primed the pump for someone to take it to court and to challenge it. And so he goes to court, they take him to court, and he has a high-profile lawyer on his case, and then it's almost like he's the evolution side, and then you have the creation side on the other side, where you have a high-profile lawyer on the creation side. So you have one side they've hired somebody that's just a really great lawyer, well-known, and then the other one, and really the evolution side didn't have a well-known super high lawyer, but he was good enough in that sense. He was kind of on the ranks going up. And so they take him to court. And here's the fascinating thing. It's 1925. The guy that was defending the creation side, it wasn't so much about whether he taught evolution. It took a turn really quickly. The guy that was talking about the creation side did a really lousy job at defending creation. He did a lousy job at defending the person altogether. While he was high profile, he just kind of went in with the, well, we all agree that he's wrong kind of a mentality. And when you go back and you read what really happened there, which I did some years ago and did a bunch of research on that, the things that he did were just, it was poorly studied, it was poorly researched, and it wasn't that great of material that he had on his side. While on the other side, the evolutionist guy that was defending the evolution side was very well researched, gave very intelligent debate, and really put a great case out there. At the end of the day, it was interesting, the evolution side lost. while they kind of won the argument, they still lost the case because everybody had this predisposition that it was going to be a loss in that part. And so the teacher was fined $100, which they found a technicality, which he got off the that fine, which in today's society that would be like $1,500 or $1,600 or something like that. Not a big deal. But here's what it did. It put on stage for everybody to see in America and really the world, because it was a big deal, in this tiny little town in Tennessee, all these reporters came. They're all looking at this, and they're like, wow, this is a big deal. What's going to happen with this? And the theory of evolution has been out for like 75 years or so at this point in time, and is beginning to be recognized as something that's important for science. And so everybody's looking and saying, what's going to happen with this? And what happened was, while the creationist side won the judge's ruling, they really lost the fight. Because as people looked in on that and wrote about that in the coming years, they would begin to look at the biblical theologians, the ones defending creation, the ones defending God or the Bible. They would look at those and say, you're unintelligent, you're uninformed, you're not keeping up with the times, you're not even having a healthy debate or conversation with the other side. And this went on for years. And really, I think it went into the 80s and 90s, and I'm seeing somewhat of a turn in the past 20 years or so, where I'm seeing a lot more intelligent debate within these kinds of settings, instead of just, we can't believe that. And so there's a degree that in the past 100 years, I believe that somewhere along the line, we've separated ourselves from science and separated ourselves from the conversation that could have happened a long time ago. More recently, I think that the church, and I want to dive into this a little bit and say and admit our fault in this. More recently, I believe the church has gone a little bit further there in that the church has become an echo chamber as well, in that we simply talk about the things we've always talked about, and we're not relating to real life that's happening around us. Okay? That's some big accusations, but some of you are saying in your mind, yeah, that's true, right? And that's why we're having this kind of a series. This is why we're talking about these things, because our kids are in school and this is what they're taught day in and day out. And how do we have any idea about how to walk through some of these things? And should we believe, should we not, and where should we fall in line with these things? So we want to have a conversation. And certainly in the next 25 minutes, I won't cover everything. Fair enough? I can't talk that fast, okay? I can try, but I'd lose, like, everybody. And here's what I see, especially in this last election. Not that I want to get into political things, but in the last election, I saw this even more so with all the issues that are being raised in our culture. The church, as I talk to the millennials and different younger people, they look at the church in so many different ways, and they say, the church is just not relating to the life that I'm living today. In that the church is not thinking about the culture that's around us. Their worldview is very different. Now, I don't get it. Now, I just don't think it's like an echo chamber. And all we talk about are the things from yesterday, not the things that are going on today. And there's some truth to that statement. And that's why we're trying to change some things here. Now, when you even yesterday was, do you know what yesterday was? Yeah, it was Saturday. What else was yesterday? Good. Some of you know it was Earth Day. And for some, you're like, what's Earth Day? What's a celebration of Earth and different things like that? And there's different protests or different things to make awareness of different parts of Earth Day. And what was interesting, there's a twist that happened down in Washington, D.C. with this, which is fascinating. I will show you a picture that I got from this. Down in Washington, D.C., this is what they were saying. Science is a nonpartisan issue. Really, it's a political statement that they're making for sure. But do you see what they did? They now Earth Day has become about science. And listen, can I just, this is not my notes, so I'm just going to take a little rabbit trail. Is it good to take care of the earth? Yes. Yeah, should we admit to that? Yes. Should we recycle? Yes. Yeah, that's just taking good care of the planet that we're living in. Should we be polluting the earth? We should do our best not to. We should be responsible with the earth that we're living in. And we should be okay with dialoguing about this as well. Not for political reasons, but because we want to be responsible with what God has given to us. and we want to keep taking some steps there. In a very simple sense, one of the things that we do in our home that I'm encouraging, we used to drink water out of water bottles a lot, okay? And so I've got 5 kids and my wife and I, and we could go through a case of water every week. And so what we did actually was we made some changes never use water bottles, but what we'll do now is we'll use a Brita pitcher or whatever, or have purified water in that kind of a sense, so that we're not using it as much. Why? It's a very simple way to be responsible in our society so that you don't have all the plastics that's being used for all kinds of things. It's just a simple thing. And we can all do our part in different ways to be more conscious of our environment. Make sense? Okay, good. But these are the conversations that we're really not having a lot of, those conversations where we have the same answers that are going on constantly and we're ignoring the culture that goes on around us. So here's what I want to do. I want to dive in and say, well, what does Jesus say about this stuff? What does he say about science and God? And evolution wasn't a thing back then, so we don't have his perspective on that, right? So let's go to Mark chapter 12, and I have it up on the PowerPoint. If you don't have your Bibles with you, if you do, this is great text to read and to get to know. But Mark chapter 12, verse 28. Here, Jesus is questioned by the scribes and the Pharisees, and one of them in particular, as it records in Matthew's recording the same thing, he's a lawyer. So a lawyer is asking him questions, and he says to him, one of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, asked him, which commandment is the most important of all? Now stop there and think. Which commandment would be the most important? Don't murder, don't lie, don't steal. Do you remember the rest? Don't covet, don't worship any other gods, don't take God's name in vain. That's pretty good. I got 6 out of 10. I can't remember the rest, but we're good now, okay? But so which one of those would be the best is the question. So here's his answer. Jesus answered, the most important is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Now this is a fascinating text because Jesus responds to this group of highly intelligent people that are trying to trick him into saying one thing so they can have a kind of an accusatory dialogue. And he says this amazing text that really summarizes everything. Jesus could do this because he's God. So he says, here's the most important. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Now he's referring back to Deuteronomy in the law, Deuteronomy chapter 6. This is the Shema passage, in the Hebrew scriptures, they would refer to this as the Shema passage. Now, the Shema passage just comes from the first caption there, Hear, O Israel. It's just the Hebrew word for hear. It's saying, hey, listen, this is an important thing to guide yourself by. And so he says, the Lord our God is one, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall, and here's what he's saying, love God with what? All your heart, all your what? Soul, all your mind and all your strength. Now, when you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6, it's interesting. He's adding something in there that it doesn't have in Deuteronomy chapter 6. He's adding in there your mind. You should love God with all your heart. Absolutely, my heart is totally loving God in that way. With all your soul, my immaterial, my spiritual being, with all my strength, everything in me is loving God. But then he says this extra thing in here, with all your mind. With all your mind. He's saying that intellectually, you should be loving God. It's not simply an emotion to love God. It's not about a feeling that when I walk out from church, it felt good to be with God, and this was great, and I feel so much better, and that's all fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But he goes a step further, and he's saying you should love God with all your mind. It's not simply an emotional experience, but an intellectual journey where we do not check our minds at the door. You don't come into church, get out of your car, and say, okay, take the thinking cap off, leave it in the car, and walk into church, and now we're just going to experience something emotionally. But instead, to love God with all your mind is to say, I'm fully engaged in my mind to understand God, to perceive who he is, to think about things that are related to life, and to really be analyzing everything around me to say, who is God? And so some of the intellectual questions that we don't often entertain, but sometimes we do better at, things like this. Why do bad things happen to good people? Have you ever thought about that? Where's God when bad things happen? Why do bad things happen to good people? Where do we come from? What's our future like? And there's a ton more, aren't there? These are intellectual questions where you're thinking about God, and you're saying, okay, who is God? And you're trying to discover more about him then. So you're loving God and thinking it through in a process where you're intelligently saying, I want to know God. I don't want to just put this off and have an emotional feeling like, yeah, he probably kind of sort of exists, and he kind of sort of has something to do with my life, and he makes me feel better in my life. But it goes a step further where you're saying, I'm intellectually engaged in who God is, and yes, there are some questions I have not answered yet. That's okay to say. So God simply encourages us to think. Recently, I was talking with a friend of mine who's of a totally different religious persuasion, who does not view Jesus as God, does not view things at all the same. And he was saying about his religion, he was saying something interesting. He said, we're taught not to think. We're taught not to think. But I could actually identify with that. Because as a kid growing up, there were times and there were things that happened within the church setting where I wasn't really allowed to question and think about some things. It was just, this is the way it is, and this is the way it's always been, so it must be okay. And it's interesting. Today, we're looking at this from a totally different perspective. And here in this church, here's where we are. We want to keep asking some of the harder questions. We want to keep dialoguing about this and not come with the dogmatic, we know everything, and if you just, you know, connected up with me, I would tell you about everything. And what we do is we don't leave it just simply as, hey, we have some questions. We then dialogue further and go deeper with some of the questions and see how it relates to life. Where are we doing that? We're doing that here in our church gathering session, and we're also doing that in small groups as well. So over the summer, we're interested to see who would be interested in having a small group discussion that just talks about science and God. Just small group discussion, not a teaching format where one person is saying, here's what you need to think and stop asking me questions, but a discussion where we actually dialogue about this. And so we're thinking about that, and that's going to be on your response card today as well. And so we want to dialogue and continue to encourage us. As God encourages us to think, we want to encourage each other to be thinking as well. So how do you do this? The Apostle Paul, who wrote a lot of the New Testament, what we have here in the letters of the New Testament that's compiled for us, he said this one thing to Timothy. Timothy was, you'd have the Apostle Paul, who's kind of like the master teacher, if you will, or the guy that's planting all these churches, and then you have Timothy, who's his right-hand man that's helping out with this certain church in Ephesus, and he's helping to pastor that one church. And he says to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:15, study. To show yourself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed. Am I saying that right? I'm just quoting this. So he says, study. It's something you should intellectually, you should be getting your mind in gear for. You should be understanding God. So you study God's word. You study this cover to cover, and you say, okay, who is God? Does God relate to science? Does science relate to God? Does this thing really work out in this way? So you study very deeply, and you walk all the way through this so that you can know God. And so as you do understand God, everything fits together, and you begin to be rightly dividing God's word and truth, and you can see how it works out together. So recently I was doing some work where I was doing some trim and cutting a different piece of trim and making some cool little things and making it fit just right. And I was excited for that, and so I got everything done, totally forgot to take a picture after I was done doing this dining room, and so I was bummed about that. So I go home, and I'm emptying out my truck, and I've got my chop saw, and I've got my tools and all the things in the back of my truck and the back and all this stuff. And so I'm emptying it out and taking it into where I store my tools. And I take my chop saw. You know what a chop saw is? Okay, it's a saw that chops like this. Okay, so it chops wood and trim and a really nice thing. And so I've had this saw. It's a Craftsman 10-inch miter saw that it was a sliding miter saw. It's a really good thing. And so it was great. And so I took the miter saw and I put it on my wheelbarrow, which I had a bunch of other tools to be able to take it back to where I was storing it. Problem. I looked away. Joel's laughing already. I looked away as I picked up the wheelbarrow, and I got distracted. I don't know, a squirrel went by, or a squirrel. And I go to then wheel the thing back. And I wasn't paying attention as I go 3 feet away, and what happens? You know what's about to happen, right? My Craftsman 10-inch sliding miter saw falls off the wheelbarrow. Now, that's not a big deal because, I mean, tools are made to handle some abuse. But there's one part that it cannot fall on. It fell on that part. It was the handle part that you need to, like, do all the actuating. It fell and it broke the handle right off. I'm like, oh, are you kidding me? And so I just looked and I'm like, well, I'll just super glue it. And so I did. It didn't work. And I felt it was an unsafe thing to use after that point. So I called my brother. I'm like, all right, I need a new miter saw, which I never mind buying new tools, but I hate buying new tools when I had a good one already. And so I called my brother, who's into woodworking and cabinet making and stuff like that, and said, so tell me, what's the best saw? And he says, well, this is the one we get for everybody, and this is a really top brand saw. Should I tell you what it is? Yeah, it's a DeWalt 12-inch compound. It was really good, okay? So I went and bought this. It was on sale, which made me even happier, right? So I bought this thing, and here's why I bought it. Here's why I bought it. You're wondering, where is he going with this? I bought this because it was well-researched by my brother, who's worked really hard at knowing the business of cutting things and knowing tools really well, and I bought it because he said this is the best one to get for your money. See, in the same kind of sense, and I got to use it yesterday. Oh, it's so nice. He's so right. So anyway, in the same kind of way where I called him, he studies to know that he's an approved craftsman of wood. So I'm looking at him saying, give me some advice here. He's mentally understanding this. He's worked this through in his life, and he gives me some great advice. And so I'm like, okay, that's the one to get. So I go and I get it based on what he said, based on the study he's done. In that kind of a way, we don't come to church and say, okay, I did my half an hour of study time. But instead, we take and we say, I'm making a lifestyle of studying out who God is. I'm going to investigate thoroughly. I'm going to make time in my schedule to know who he is so that I can say, God really exists, or I don't know that God relates to this part of my life, or that he does. And we walk it through in our life on a constant basis. We're always learning. And so that's what Paul is admonishing us to do, encouraging us to do. And so he says in another book in Romans, he says to the church there, and this is all related to saying, okay, we need to love God with all our mind. We're thinking people. We didn't check our brains at the door. So in Romans chapter 1, Paul says to the church that's in Rome, he says to them, he says, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. He says, you want to know God? Listen, God's shown it already. He's identified himself. And where has he identified himself? Verse 20 says, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. The psalmist in Psalm chapter 19, he says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Here's what I'm getting at. Nature is our guide, and it points toward complexity. When we look around, we study God's word, and we say, okay, I get that. And you say, well, I have some struggles with the Bible. Fine, so let's look around at nature around us. Do you realize that we're supposed to be studying nature as well in order to understand who God is? It declares his glory. And so I just want to highlight five quick things about the complexity of this universe. Okay, and I'm not a huge scientist. I don't have PhDs that would back this up. This is from other people that have done this study. So here's the first one. The gravitational force. Gravitational force. Could you imagine if the gravitational force was off just a little bit and we couldn't sit on our pews? Could you imagine that? How would you get in your car? Yeah. Okay. How would you go to the store? Yeah. You'd never be able to build a car. Listen, if the gravitational force was off just a little bit, we could not survive. Have you thought about that? There is no survival if it's off just by a smidgen. Another one. The electromagnetic force. This is a good one. This is a really smart intellectual word. This is the protons, neutrons, the different small atomic and molecular structures that are bonded together in the ways that only science can really describe appropriately. But as you study that, you understand that there's this magnetic force that holds everything together, that works everything out. When I have wood, I can knock on wood, right? I look at my body and it's staying together. That's all part of the force that God has intended, that I believe is designed by God. It's complex. If that was off just by a tiny bit, we'd have nothing. We'd have nothing. Another one, the composition of our atmosphere. If the gases were wrong, we'd die. It's pretty simple. If the gases were wrong, we would die. If they were wrong, we'd never be here. This planet could not survive. And you look at other planets, and there's no life there. Why? Because the gases and things are not right. And another one, the properties of the elements. Have you ever thought about that? What if water was not H2O? What if it was 3 hydrogen? Right? 1 oxygen, right? H3O? I know it's H2O, but what if it was H3O? It wouldn't be water. It wouldn't exist. Think about the complexity of the universe to the degree that if it's off by just one tiny little part, we would not survive. And one more, our solar system. When you look at our solar system, do you realize we have to have a moon? Do you realize that the sun has to be at the right position in order for us to survive? Any closer, it fries us. Any further away, we freeze to death. So we have all these things working out, and they have all these planets, all these stars that are doing all this stuff, and you can do a big art project with all the things that are going all over the place. But it works out perfectly to the degree that you can calculate hundreds of years in advance or hundreds of years in the past and things that were going on in the solar system, because it's a system and it works perfectly together. If it was off just by a little bit, there is no life. There is no life. Both here, when you look at all of this is simply statements of complexity. And so the theist, let me kind of dive into this, the theist, who that's who I am, a theist, I believe in God, would say God created complexity. God created complexity. That's what I go to the table with. The atheist would say chance created complexity. Chance created complexity. That these complex things were made by chance, or these complex things were made by God. And to go a little bit further, you would look at the theist who would say everything came from God. Everything came from God. And so God created complexity, and essentially everything then came from God. Or the atheist, chance created complexity, everything then came from what? Nothing. So you'd have to rationally work those things through and intellectually understand and decide where you're heading with that. Do you understand complexity? Let me describe that for you. Complexity is so intricate, so complex. Last night, Friday night, I'm sorry, I went up to see my daughter Jillian in concert up at Karen University. And so they had this concert with voices. Almost all of their songs were done a cappella, very little instrumentation. So they had like 30 or 40 students that were singing. And the first couple songs they started out with, the first song was a Bach song, okay? Now, if you're not into classical music, you'd be not enjoying this as much. But I sat there, and I just loved this to death. And the conductor said, hold your applause to the third segment, which was killing me. Because the first song was one phrase. It was one phrase that he continued to just make transitions to and do all kinds of nuances to, and they had several voices. I think it was six voices, six different parts that they were doing, and it was 32 pages long. Jillian showed it to me afterwards. She said, Dad, 32 pages, look. It was a ton of work. I sat there in the audience, and I'm like, wow, this is incredible. And I've got chills that they're hitting these different parts and doing this and harmonizing over here, and the bass comes in and does this, and then the tenor does this, and soprano and the other, and they're doing these things, and you're like, wow, this is totally incredible. It's complex. And I look and say, wow, this is amazing to be able to just sit here and enjoy this concert. Now, some of you wouldn't enjoy that. You're like, oh, man, that would be like taking a nap for me. You know, this pretty music's putting me to sleep, you know. So maybe you'd do sports. Okay? Who's playing right now? We have basketball championships, right? You're working toward that, am I right? Okay, who's the star basketball player that's kind of hot right now? Okay, Curry. Okay, James. Okay, LeBron James. Okay, so we have a couple of those. Think about this. And I watch a little bit of basketball, but I'm not totally familiar. Stephen Curry. Let me just pick on him because I think he's pretty cool. Okay? He's really cool because he goes up, and most people, see, he shoots the way I should shoot, okay? LeBron James, you'll understand this in a second. LeBron James is like 20 feet tall, right? So he goes by everybody, and he's like really huge, and he can go, and he jumps, and he scores and everything, and he's great at doing all of that stuff, and he really is that good, okay? Stephen Curry, he goes in, and he dribbles it around, and he shoots from like 40 feet out, you know? Why? Just because he's got that good of a shot. And I've tried to do that. I'll play pig or I'll play horse with people, and I'm shooting. I'll be like, yeah, I'm Stephen Curry, you know, air ball, right? Why? And here's what I discover. I discover very quickly that what they do in basketball is very complex. It's hard to do. It's not easy at all. And here's what we're talking about. Complexity in those small ways where you're training people very hard for something to be able to do this sport and or do this music in such a great way. It didn't come from chance. Listen, if you go to a third grade concert, you'll say when harmony happens, sometimes that's chance. You follow me? And I've been to something like, whoa, oh, there it is. You got the magic note, right? But when you get into that level, this is not chance. They've worked hours and hours and hours at this to be able to come up with something that is that complex. And so this is why I will lean into being a theist, where I'll say God created complexity. Everything came from God. Where'd God come from? He always existed. Yes, here's the reality. Both of these, all of these things here, they're simply statements of faith. Do you realize that? If you believe in atheism, this is a statement of faith as well. If you believe in theism, it's a statement of faith. To be able to say chance created complexity, to say everything came from nothing, it's a statement of faith. It's not scientific in that sense. So here's my point. To kind of bring it down into one point and bring it to a close. Here's my point. Yeah, both are statements of faith, but here's the point. Science is not the enemy of God. It is the evidence of God. Science is not the enemy of God. It is the evidence of God. Instead of assuming that the opponent is the enemy, let's keep our mind engaged. That's my point. We should be thinking people. To love God with all our mind is saying, okay, I understand that, and I want to understand what science is saying about this thing that they're discovering and scientifically dive into that so they can understand who God is that much more and understand how this relates to God all the way through. Robert Jastrow, who a really smart guy, and he died a few years ago, but he wrote this book, God and the Astronomers. He says this. I think it summarizes what I'm trying to say very well. By the way, he's not a Christian, okay? He would describe himself as an agnostic. He says, for the scientist that has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends in a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. It's a fascinating statement that he makes. And he's not a Christian, he's making that statement. So here's my point. Two things. Science is best to stick to being scientific. Science is best to stick to being scientific. Just be scientific. Don't go with assumptions into it. Just simply be scientific. Without the assumption, I'm just going at it and being scientific. I'm studying this and I'm understanding this that much more. In Christianity, secondarily, Christianity is best to stick to being Christ-centered. It's best to stick to being Christ-centered. So what does that mean? I'm going to study science. I'm going to know science. I want to understand. I want to perceive. I want to determine who is God and how does this relate to my life. And then as I follow that all the way through, I want to finish the statement that Jesus made in Mark chapter 12. Because he said, love God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, your strength. Love God with everything. But then there's a second statement he adds on. I love this, because this is how it relates to all of us today. He says, the second commandment is like this. He says, you should love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. What does that look like? I believe that Christians should be the most loving people around. Should be the most sincere, the most thinking things through kind of a person. They didn't check their minds at the door and just have emotional feelings for everybody and good tidings kind of a thing. But they intellectually, they've studied, they know who God is, and they intellectually know that God loves them so much that he sent Jesus Christ to pay for their sins so that by believing in Jesus, they have a relationship with God that is ongoing for this life and all eternity. And so in a reflection, understanding as to how messed up of an individual we are, that God graciously and lovingly said, I want a relationship with you. In that same kind of way, I am loving on my neighbor. So when I have dialogues about science with people that they're atheist or agnostic or whoever it might be, instead of being so hostile and angry, why can't we love them? Why can't we have a conversation that lasts for years, centuries even? Well, decades, right? And we continue to have a conversation that lovingly guides and lovingly works through some things where we discover some things, they get to discover some things, and we learn more about God, they learn who God is, and we have this kind of thing going on constantly. That's where God wants us to be, where we love enough to understand the truth, we love enough to walk through and understand who God is, and we have a conversation that continues to be open and honest with people around us. Of all the things to really dive into, and there's so much more, isn't there? Maybe you came this morning, you're like, is he going to touch on this? And I didn't touch on it, and you're disappointed. There's not enough time, is there? We could go on for days and days and never plumb the depths of all these things. Why? Because God is so vast. The universe is so vast. And so I want to keep it simple. To love God and love each other in a way that's appropriate and right. And keep pushing in that direction. Not to check our brains at the door, not in any way. But we intellectually love God. We intellectually, we're thinking people that love each other. Yeah, but what if they're wrong? What if they hurt me? We still intellectually love God. Have you ever been wrong with God? That would be a yes. But God still loves us. He doesn't quit on us. And that's where we should be with the people around us. Would you do that with me? So today,